Why do you say that, Father? You aren't afraid, are you?
No. But I respect some of the superstitions of others. Often they are founded in fact.
Broadcasting live from our Sanctum Sanctorum in Venice, California, this is the Sixth Sense Society. I'm your host, Krista, here with our producer, Michael, and today you'll be hearing us talk about the tarot. And Michael chose a focus that we're calling it Tarot Secrets and Symbols. And I particularly like the idea of the symbols, and I'll tell you why at the beginning of the show. But before we get started, Michael has a few announcements.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to our broadcast. We've got a couple great shows coming up. Next week, we have our first show we've been wanting to do forever on remote viewing with Earl Grey Anderson. So we're extremely excited about that. And then our final show this last Tuesday of this month will be an extended 90-minute special on magic with author Brandy Williams and witchcraft practitioner Sandra Inman and ceremonial magician Mavius Lynn. So going to be some great shows coming up, and then we're into October with all our paranormal friends, so lots of cool stuff. Get all the information on our website, sixthsensesociety.com, S-A-X-T-H, all spelled out, and while you're there, buy us a coffee on Ko-Fi. But the main thing is click like and subscribe. That helps us tremendously. And I'm not going to take up too much time today, because I know you guys are all into tarot, and we want to kind of dig into some of the stuff that we think about it. And Krista and I have been practicing it now for over 26 years as professional readers, so feel free to pick our brains. If you have any questions about it, just hit a comment, and we'll try and answer your questions for you. So with that, I'm going to kick it back to you, Krista. So take it away, Krista.
Great. Thank you, Michael. Yes. And welcome. I want to say welcome to Caroline. I'm glad you are here, and we hope you will also chime in, as she's also a card reader and astrologer, and she's been on the show before. So thanks for tuning in. And Mark Coates, thanks for tuning in, too. So one of the reasons I got excited about this idea of focusing on symbolism is because the tarot is the most symbolic tool you can imagine. And in symbolism is, in my mind, the language of the unconscious. And so there's so many ways you can approach the symbolic side of the tarot side. It is a symbolic thing. And the other reason I really think it's good to talk more freely about the tarot and symbolism is, for whatever reason, modern tarot readers, at least some of the popular interpretations, have really gotten away from the symbolic nature, and they will literally interpret cards. And honestly, it's not in most of the books that were developed around tarot, because I've read Arthur Waite's Smith's book, I've read Crowley's book, I've recently read this book by Ben Dove, who talks about the Marseille deck, which is totally about symbolism. So it's more of a new thing, to tell you the truth. And so I'm sort of perplexed by that. But before I continue, what do you think about just this topic, Michael? So what do you like about it?
Yeah, I think that obviously the tarot is an incredibly symbolic tool. And I know Crowley said that he thought that the two most significant tools for divination were tarot and I Ching. And I think that there is a lot of symbolism in it. I think it also has to be married a little bit with that structure in the Kabbalah that we talk about. And one of the things that I've often thought is that if you don't really understand the deeper teaching, that the images in a tarot deck, especially like the Waite deck, can be a little misleading. But if you understand the philosophy, it kind of reinforces that teaching and that lesson. So left-hand pillar in particular, I think a lot of people really misinterpret and misunderstand what that means. And I basically don't see anything positive in it when there really is a lot of positive. And I think that all of the cards, what makes them positive or negative are whether you're fighting the energy or not. So again, if you're working in harmony with an energy, you're giving when you're supposed to give, taking when you're supposed to take, speaking when you're supposed to speak, listening when you're supposed to listen, then generally it turns into something positive. But if you're at odds with it, speaking when you're supposed to listen and being aggressive when you're supposed to, hold back, then it causes problems. So it's really that misuse or that not being in harmony with an energy that really causes the conflict. But it's a fascinating tool. And again, 26 years in, and Krista and I have done, tens of thousands of readings, and I still find it fascinating. And even every once in a while, you'll still see a new insight on one of the cards that you hadn't really thought of it that way before. And again, it's not really changing the interpretation. It's just another facet, another way of looking at the energy. But it's a fantastic thing. And I think tarot just an endlessly fascinating study.
It's true. And one of the things I would say, just in the last 2 years, I've been collecting, I'm trying to collect the significant books that have been written about the tarot throughout the ages. And I had this goal of like reading them in order, and that's not happening. But I do pick them up and read them when I feel the mood or a move to do it. And lately I've been interested in comparing the different versions of the cards in terms of their imagery. And one of the most, I would say, important things when you're looking at the symbolism of the tarot is to A, use the same deck for a while, and B, actually look at the cards all of the time. I mean, it seems like a no-brainer, but all of us can kind of tune them out. If you say, oh, I know this deck, I've been reading with it for 5 years, I know what that image is. And what happens is something might strike you that you weren't really looking at before. This is what's so interesting. And this is why it's also good for the Crowley deck to use the bigger version, because there's so much in it, like literally, and it's harder when the smaller the image gets. But if you even compare, like, one of the cards I'm going to talk about symbolically is the Three of Swords, because that one really gets kind of messed up a lot. And the earlier versions of the Three of Swords, of course, there's no negative imagery in it. And it really, because of that, it relies more on either the way the swords are placed to interpret it, or the fact that it's three and what does the number three. So that's, and I think that's important, is whatever deck you're using to kind of give it like some power and say, oh, this deck thinks that this artwork in the deck is really this way, and therefore I am meant to translate that, and not just superimpose a memorized definition of the Three of Swords in this case.
Yeah, I think the left-hand pillar in particular, you know, threes, fives, eights, people do see them typically sort of negatively, but they're really not designed to be in specifically that way. And they certainly can be. There can be an element of angst with those cards for sure, and a defeated kind of energy. But at the same time, it's also an energy of commitment. It's an energy of compassion. It's an energy of analysis and reflection. And so all of these things are also true, and people sometimes don't really see that. And sometimes I think that the imagery is great, but I also think sometimes it kind of becomes a little dogmatic, and people start to see the energy just in one specific way and not really seeing it holistically the way that they probably should.
I totally agree. And I've caught myself, maybe in the beginning I did that a little, and what I would do to balance it is I would use a deck that had no imagery in the minor cards. Like, I think I've talked before, I love Courtney Davis's Celtic Tarot, and all you see are the numbers, the knotwork numbers, and it gives my mind a break from, you know, reacting to the imagery. But there's nothing wrong. In fact, the imagery, when I've been really lately thinking about the ones that look particularly disturbing, they're not what you think. That's what's so interesting. Like, when you look at the tarot, like, for instance, when you look at symbolism, normally, like, if you interpret your own dreams, most dream interpreters say to start with what it means to you personally. But if you're going to be reading for the public a lot, like we do, you would probably want to try with the more universal things that image can mean. And obviously one of a really simple one is the Fool. And the Fool appears in so many cultures as a trickster, coyote. And so it's an archetypal energy that many, many cultures have. And so these are the symbols that are really profound with the tarot. And you can find them, they're somewhat ignored in the minor cards, but they're just as profound. And Michael and I have talked about that on the show, how minor and major are equally important. There isn't just, you know, the major is more important. There are people that just do decks only on the major arcana. And I don't think that's true at all. It's just different. You know, it's just, in a way, it kind of is nice and refreshing to have images and not have images, you know.
Yeah, and with minor and major arcana, yeah, there's that tendency to start to think, because of the wording, that major must be more important because it's called major, minor must be less important because it's called minor. But that's not really the context for the words, and I always tell people, think of it like music, and you wouldn't say that a major chord is more important than a minor chord, you know, that they're both of equal value, they're just somewhat different. But if you were to remove all the minor chords and so forth and scales, your music would sound pretty terrible, you know, because they are equally valuable. So really think of it in musical terms, as I said, major and minor in that sense, rather than in the subjective sense of value.
So one of the things I wanted to talk about are some of the ways you can study symbolism And what I would say that I wouldn't try necessarily to read the symbols while doing a reading. I would inform myself by studying them away from the reading, let them kind of sink in. And there's a couple of overall points I wanted to make from the very beginning. One is that if you study, like we do, the Tree of Life, the Kabbalah, that is itself a symbol. And it's a big, complex symbol, but it's every time we do a reading in my mind, I see as much as I see anything, but, you know, I imagine the Tree of Life. And so you are using this symbol that is a beautiful symbol of what some people see as the blueprint of any creation. And also because it's called a tree, trees are throughout all cultures important symbolically. So you're already working with a symbol in the sense that it's always in your mind, working on a subconscious level. The other thing I wanted to mention too is that not only can you look at the cards symbolically on an individual level, but you can start noticing patterns of symbolism. Like Michael once noticed, the right-hand pillar cards, the major arcana, are mostly individual figures. And that fed in symbolically to what we understand the right-hand pillar to be about.
Yeah, and it's really kind of that elevation of self, you know, so we're separating ourselves from our traditions and our peers and kind of charting our own new unique path forward and so forth with that energy, braving the unknown. And that's why I think Kabbalah is very important, and understanding some of the Tree of Life, at least as it relates to tarot, is very important. And unfortunately, I think a lot of the books even gloss over that or don't even touch on it. And because it really does flesh out, you know, a lot of aspects and elements of the cards and the symbolism. And then I think the beauty of symbolism, again, is the idea that it isn't dogmatic. You know, once we write things down, it becomes very narrow in terms of what it means. Whereas with a symbol, it's a living, breathing thing. And as I said, you know, I'm still discovering facets of some of the cards that I, after 26 years and tens of thousands of readings, you would say, okay, I've seen it all. And every once in a while, you'll see the fool in a different light or something where you'll say, I never really thought of it in those particular terms. Because again, it's not dogmatic. It's not tied into that specific language. And that's the beauty of any symbol, any symbolic tool, that's really its beauty.
Yeah, symbols are very dynamic to me. And they can evolve with your own understanding of the universe. And for instance, for whatever reason, about 2 years ago, someone said something about the Three of Swords in a book that was very erudite, and or it was on a, maybe it was on a podcast, but the person was intellectually very well versed in tarot, very well versed. And she immediately said, oh, the Three of Swords is a breakup card. And okay, you know, I'm not going to say no one could ever break up under the Three of Swords, but my experience of it is completely different. So I actually decided to look at the symbol a little more deeply, besides my own interpretation. And the one card I wanted to use was the Weight deck because it's so famous. It's just a simple heart with three swords piercing it. And the first thing you immediately can see is the heart is not broken. It is taking the swords in. It's there like a presence, like, oh, you know, but it's as if it can handle it on some level. And then I thought, well, isn't that an emblem of Mary? Isn't, and I don't know that kind of iconography. And so I had to research, and yes, the Mary's heart is sometimes pierced with one sword, three swords, or seven of swords. This completely fits with the connection of the threes in general to Bina, the Great Mother. And that is what it's referring to. It's referring to, and then when you look at it Kabbalistically, that is a very interesting sephira. It's a great and terrible mother. It's connected to creation. And one of the things I do love about Crowley, he always talks about the Kabbalah with the cards and sometimes over your head, or he'll refer to another book like he does with the Three of Swords, but he's always talking about it. And he'll get you interested in going and studying it yourself. But one of my favorite lines about Bina comes from Dionne Fortune's book. And I was actually studying that for a different reason. And she talks about, this is a place where form disciplines force with a merciless severity. So what they're talking about in some way is that by the time you reach the threes, you're beginning to create something. And it's a painful process. It is not easy. And so on sort of a more, you know, maybe philosophical level, You can see that. But also you could even just see, based on what we know, that the three, the high end of all of the threes, is seeking some kind of understanding and compassion. And so, you know, I always, when I talk about the Three of Swords especially, I'll give people sort of the range of things I've seen people do with that card. And to be honest, I don't think I've seen anyone break up over the Three of Swords, but I have seen families go into chaos, not communicating, and just everyone reacting and it getting worse. I have seen that, like, specifically. So that kind of reactive energy with the Three of Swords can definitely be there, depending on the level of consciousness. And it can also represent this deep desire to be of help and to do something helpful, but maybe you don't know what actions to take, you know? So I love that, for whatever reason, the idea that it's a deeply spiritual image gets completely overlooked in modern tarot books. And it's not, I don't think so in some of the older books, because they were so into symbolism, you know? And I wish that more people would, you know, just consider that. And you can, you know, you can interpret it the way you want after you look at the symbol, but it makes you think of it from a different angle.
Yeah, I was going to say, I very rarely disagree with Krista, but I was going to do it a little bit this time, in the sense that I don't think anyone really does break up on the Three of Swords. However, it could very easily be the beginning of the end, for sure, because it's just not progressed far enough. But with that three, sometimes, again, you know, in the negative sense, we start to confront our doubts and our fears and uncertainties. We start to kind of think about that stuff. We're reflecting, is this really kind of what I want to continue to experience or do? I'm not sure, you know, with the three, there's always that questioning aspect to it. So if you think about it again, you know, if it's, it appertains to a relationship, which you could easily do career as well, but that idea that I'm even questioning things, that's not necessarily a good sign for a relationship. Why would I be, you know, going over and reflecting and asking myself questions about it? I should be content. I should be somewhat satiated. So again, there is that disturbed element of it, but not disturbed in a negative sense, just the idea that it's not content, you know. And as Krista said, you know, sometimes that can be the idea of, you know, trying to question things and decide if this is something that I want to put up with, or is there something I can do about it? But there is that element of reflection in the three. And as I said, in a negative sense, it does express its doubts and its fears and its uncertainties and so forth. But it is that great question, you know, should we continue and or do something different? And that's where the question is being asked, is at the three.
Yeah, I it would probably have to do with the placement of it for me. And it would also have to do with the following cards. But I think it's too early. I've always felt, generally speaking, unless you have a lot of threes, that it's still too early to say what's going to happen. And in, like, for in long-term relationships, if you never have any threes and fives, you're going to have a really boring relationship. So I don't quite agree that just because a person's questioning the relationship that they're going to possibly lead to breaking up. And again, because I think relationships, especially over a long period of time, like even friendships, they go through changes. So let's say I have a friend I've had for years, and let's say we go to all the spiritual same things together, and then one day they become a born-again Christian. And then you're like, uh-oh, what's going to happen? And let's say you're a witch, you know? So maybe there are going to be some concerns. And let's say that they're okay with it. They accept you and they don't expect you to change. So I think that the threes definitely do have that kind of angst. But I also really, really can see where they have the potential for deep compassion. I think particularly the Three of Swords, because of its connection to the imagery. And the other thing is, when I think of the Three of Swords, if you think of the, you know, representing the Sacred Heart, I would say personally, it might represent more of the pain of possibly losing a child, because of the connection to Mary and Jesus. I'm wondering if they're better cards to look for romantic relationship, potentially breakups, because of that sort of mythology, which also goes with a lot of the tarot decks. You know, Aleister Crowley's deck is full of all the different mythologies you can think of, from Osiris to Isis. And that's another way you can kind of explore the tarot on your own to see if you can come to some understanding of why that card has Isis on it, or whoever it is, Venus on it.
Yeah, and I just wanted to kind of, you know, go over this thing. We've done it in other shows too, talked about it, that some people have such a negative image of Crowley and his deck, you know, because if they've heard that he's evil and, you know, sacrificed babies and all this foolishness. so that they don't want to even look at his deck. And unfortunately, I think they're missing out. It is truly an absolute masterpiece of tarot, and it's so rich in symbolism. Even the colors, you know, he specifically chose to represent a certain mood and a certain energy. All the geometrical patterns in it, it's just an absolutely splendid, splendid deck. And as I said, probably one of the true masterpieces of tarot. So I would certainly encourage people to give it a second look if they haven't really studied that deck. You know, the book that goes with it, Book of Thoth, I always tell people good news, it's by Crowley, bad news, it's by Crowley. And so it's incredibly intelligent, but it's also filled with riddles and metaphor and, you know, good luck in picking it up and skimming through it and understanding what you're reading. It took us years to kind of puzzle it out and figure it out and so forth. You have to kind of get that inside joke sometimes. And I remember the Moon card is one of those that always stood out for me, where he talks about the typical things with it, that it's foolishness and it's madness and deception and all these things, which are typically stereotypical things said about it. But then he says, but oh, the adventure. And so he kind of twists it on its head at the very end, and that's Crowley. So as I said, you know, try not to let preconceived ideas, you know, prevent you from working with an absolutely masterful deck.
Yeah, I did want to read a little bit just to show you his writing is just really beautiful. And a lot of it you will be able to get right away, but definitely it went over all the magical terminology completely. I didn't know any of that at the time, so it was really hard. But what he says in, first he has in his Book of Thoth, he has the four threes all sort of grouped together, and then he does each of them separately as well. So in that part, he says about the Three of Swords, the idea of division of mutability, the idea of the airy quality of things manifests itself in the Three of Swords, the Lord of Sorrow. Here one is reminded of the darkness of Binna, of the mourning of Isis, but this is not any vulgar sorrow dependent upon any individual disappointment or discontent. It is Weltschmerz, I'm sure I said that wrong, it's a German word, the universe of sorrow. It is the quality of melancholy. So here, that's where you see he's trying to get you to think of it, you know, on a different scale. And of course, you can do the mundane predictions too. I'm not saying you can't, but what will happen is if you study the symbolism away from your readings, you'll start having these thoughts that will arise naturally in a reading that for whatever reason are triggered by what you see. And so that's how it seems to work for me, is that, you know, that's why contemplating, looking at the imagery all the time, like Michael says, you'll suddenly see something new even after many years, or just a new maybe take on something, like a slightly different angle. And that's why I think the tarot is probably one of the most profound systems of contemplation there is in the divination world anyway.
Yeah, and that this again brings me back to the left-hand pillar again, you know, threes and fives and eights and the hangman and the chariot and so forth. And again, you know, one of the great, great, great positive aspects of that pillar is the ability for compassion and remorse. Because it does have regret, and that can be a positive thing. Whenever we're kind of working with someone who may have wronged us and so forth, if we can determine that there's actual true remorse there, then that means that they are redeemable. And when people are filled with ego and they have no remorse, you know, they're celebratory in nature, that right-hand pillar where they just want to get on with things and they don't really care. It's a problem. So again, you know, that's an idea of how the left-hand pillar, it's something I look for. Again, if I see someone's had an issue in a relationship and their partner is genuinely remorseful for whatever happened, I do believe that there can be healing and redemption for the relationship. But if I'm not seeing the remorse, or the regrets or the concern or all different ways of expressing it, that consideration, then I don't think they're working with very much. So it really comes down to, again, is this an appropriate energy? And I like to always put it that way. Does this suit the purpose of the situation? If a person got married and they're expressing remorse of having gotten married, that's not a good sign. If they, you know, got in a fight with their wife and that they're remorseful for whatever they said or did, then that's a wonderful thing. It shows that they do care and that they really are taking it seriously. So again, remorse itself is a neutral concept. It's how well it fits a certain situation and quote unquote, is it appropriate? And that's always what I'm always looking for, are energies, appropriate energies. If they are, great. And if they're not, then that could be problematic.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. And I do think that the left-hand pillar and the cards there are often likely to be misinterpreted. We do have an interesting question coming in. Can you elucidate any of the difference in symbolism between the Thoth and the RWS deck? Wow, that is a big question. I know the order of trumps and even names were changed. Well, that's something I do. Lately, I've been comparing some of the symbolism. Like I did an article in the Nine of Swords, and I looked at some of the differences. And probably my first answer to that is I'm not an expert on any of the symbolism of the decks. And I will say that from what I can tell with Aleister Crowley is one of his intentions with his deck was to have it represent the new Aeon, the Aeon of Horus. And so he has a lot more Egyptian symbolism tied in literally into the cards themselves. You can see it in so many of the cards. And he also has, of course, added in astrological symbols for the minor arcana, as well as the major. He has the Hebrew letters, also I Ching. So he's really made it into a system that really tries to integrate a lot of other systems. I think Waits was obviously familiar with Kabbalah. It's not necessarily, as evident that it's in the cards, but, you know, the Three of Swords in, for instance, in the Waits deck and the Three of Swords in Aleister Crowley's deck, they're very similar in interpretation. They both have sort of a dark background. But I would say there's a lot more complexity and layers, which I really like in the Thoth deck. And yes, they've also changed some. I don't know if that was Waits. That was the Golden Dawn that changed the positions are with the Golden Dawn, where the Star and the Emperor are in a different place in the tree. And then the numbers for the Strength card and Justice are changed. So I don't know if that was really Waits doing. That was more of the Golden Dawn's doing.
Yeah, and just to come back again to Mark's question, the name changes themselves are not such an issue. It's adjustment instead of justice, it's, you know, art instead of temperance, it's Aeon instead of judgment, rather. Don't know if I said the right thing there, but adjustment and justice. So again, you know, that the words are appropriate, they're just kind of a different word, but, you know, again, kind of means more or less the same thing in many respects, maybe slightly more accurate element or understanding of it a little bit. The switching of the star position on the Tree of Life with the Emperor, again, those two are very similar energies. They're not radically different energies. One is a little bit more physical, one is a little more conceptual. And so he took the physical card of the Emperor and moved it down to the more physical position at the bottom of the tree, took the more, you know, conceptual card of the star, and he moved it up to the top. But again, very similar orientations, very similar energies. And I think that was a good change. And I've always taught Crowley's placement because I really do think it makes a lot of sense. And then he switched the numbers of the Strength card and Justice, the 8 and 11 that he swapped. And he does make an argument in his book about why he did that. I'm not so sure I buy that, but again, maybe. So I'm not going to say that's right or wrong. I guess we can debate that, you know, endlessly. And then he did change the court cards a little bit. So in the Rider-Waite system, you have kings, queens, knights and pages. In Crowley system, it's knight, queen, prince, and princess. And he said he wanted to do that to balance the masculine and feminine energies a little bit more. So you have a queen and a princess. You have a knight instead of the king, right, and the prince. So it gives you a balance of masculine and feminine energy in the deck, which I think is a clever thing. And I think that that actually was a good change as well. But you have to be very careful when you're doing readings for people if they're used to one system, especially with the knight being a king in the Crowley system and a totally different energy in the Waits system. You have to make sure that you translate. And that's probably the most confusing change. But again, you know, other than the number thing, which I debate and go back and forth on, I do think a lot of his changes, I think, were well done, you know, and I think very appropriate.
Yeah, actually, the more I think about it, there are some very obvious differences. For instance, the Pip cards, there are more images of people in the minor cards than in Aleister Crowley's. Lady Frieda Harris had that synthetic geometric design where everything is a little bit more analytical or geometric. So she gets away from having people, but it's still not the same as the Marseille deck, which is very simple with the three cups in a certain formation. And the images of the people in the minor cards, some people think Pamela Coleman Smith was the first to do that, but that's not true. The Solobuska deck has that, and she supposedly got some inspiration from that deck. And that has caused, unfortunately, some deep misinterpretations of the cards, such as in the Eight of Cups, there's a figure in black and he's turned and it's like everyone's depressed. Well, you can't tell what he's feeling. His face is turned. The same with Michael had pointed out, we talk about the Nine of Swords all the time. You can't tell what the Nine of Swords is feeling. Their face is covered. So people really, sometimes I kind of wish there weren't any people in the minor cards, even though it's kind of cool, actually, if you start looking at them and seeing like, well, why is that figure turned? And why are they wearing yellow? And why are they wearing red and black? And, you know, that's what you're supposed to do, because Waite was really big on symbolism. He talks about it. And if you read the pictorial key to the tarot, so it's all meant to be symbolic. And so interesting note, I think I might have mentioned this before, but the Eight of Cups was inspired by an actual eclipse that Pamela Coleman Smith saw. So you'll see this eclipse in that card. It's so cool when you find out things like that. I love that. Those little tidbits of things in the card. So anyway, that is also different, totally different. What Crowley took out the people in the minor cards. And even though it's not like the Marseille deck, it's more, you know, designed in this sort of really cool synthetic geometry. It's a specific way of doing art that Lady Frieda Harris was good at.
Yeah, and the other thing that to mention too is, and again, this is to all readers out there truly, is to try and be careful not to draw your own prejudices into the cards, especially when you're learning to interpret them. You have to try and sort of look at them in a very neutral and objective way. And I know when we do classes, it's sometimes easier to work with brand new people than it is with people that have some experience with the tarot, because we come at it in a somewhat different than they're used to kind of point of view, and we have to sort of convince them to forget what they think they know and to open their mind to a new understanding of it. And sometimes they struggle with that a little bit, at least at the beginning, because it is really a little bit of difference. And I do think, as I said, that in my mind, some of what's in the tarot books are kind of mistakes and misconceptions about things. So, you know, I would say Kabbalistically, we don't quite agree with it. You know, the death card, for example, not being actual death. And I've said this many times, and it's just not in the right placement to be an ending like death in the tree of life. You know, it's more of a point of reaching a point of action, but it's the idea of mortality. And Krista found that in a obscure reference somewhere to the tarot, that it was a misinterpretation and it shouldn't be called death, it should be called mortality. And mortis, the root of the word. But again, the idea that time is of the essence, feeling that pressure of time, the need to act, you know, urgently and so forth, not having that discipline to kind of go slowly and wait. And that's essentially what it is. It's kind of that awareness of the relevance of time and things, you know, and the idea of being mortal, you know, that ticking clock where if I don't do it now, it may never happen kind of thing. We feel that pressure and that presence of time with that particular energy. And that's what the card's all about, but it's certainly not a death card. And the true death cards in the major card are really the moon card, the world or universe card, depending on your deck, and judgment or aeon, depending again on your deck, the three at the bottom. And they're all very different. You know, the idea of aeon judgment is the idea of reaching the end of energy. You know, I've just kind of run out of life or run out of time. So it's kind of the exhausted energy, if you will. So death by old age, death by natural causes. The moon card, people have some say or control over that. So that would be more of a suicidal type of death, you know, where I choose to undergo this experience. I've kind of had a hand in it on some level. And then the in-between one, the world or universe card, is kind of that divine death, if you will, which means that it was for the greater good, kind of the heroic death, if you will. The person that throws himself on the grenade to save 10 of their friends kind of thing. And we don't sometimes even think of it hardly as a death card simply because those things are so rare. But that would be what it would be, is something which would serve the greater good on some level. So basically, those are the three death cards. And the death card itself isn't one of them. So it's actually, it just goes to show you can't take the cards literally. If you're just taking them literally at face value, you're going to get misled. Even by the wording themselves, it'll probably mislead you.
I blame Hollywood for the death card, because they're always showing it in these like movies and murders and, oh, they picked the death card, you know. But Michael is absolutely right about, you know, looking at cards like the death card and really looking at the symbolism. And yes, I agree with him with his, you know, I think I've talked about this before too, that which cards really could be death. And of course, they're not always death. That's the tricky part. We have another sort of comment question from Caroline, who says, the eclipse in the Eight of Cups, can you say more about that? Oh, you got me on that one. You're the one to answer the question about eclipses. I study astrology, and I just don't have a point of view about eclipses. I've tried to. I've read what people say about eclipses, and I haven't gathered what I think about it, other than it is very prominent in the card. So I would say, since you're an astrologer, in your case, you could use that interpretation. It could also be a timing thing. If you know there's an eclipse coming, it could be a good way to use timing. What I was struck with the Eight of Cups was in the weight deck was that the way the cups are actually stacked, it's very Kabbalistic. You have these two cups. There's three cups on top of five. So three and five, which is, guess what? The three, the five, and the eight. It's the left pillar. And the three is a two cups and a one. So it's telling me the origins of the Eight of Cups. It's brilliant. It's going from the ace, the two, three, but it's coming down the left pillar. And so I thought there might be some way, if I was like, let's say I'm baffled by what's going on in my life with the Eight of Cups, since cups to us are your life, maybe I can look to, I can go back in time and try and see where the seed of something started that is coming to fruition. And I would say that maybe the eclipse, you know, just kind of, eclipses are intense. That much I do know. And the Eight of Cups can be intense, but not always. I've seen it be super subtle. I've seen it be one of these things that kind of goes under the radar a little bit. And it all depends on the whole reading with the Eight of Cups. But it is coming to a culmination in a sense that, you know, but I'm wondering if you could use the eclipse for timing, if you could also look at it for in terms of the intensity of things. I can't remember what kind of eclipse this is that Pamela Coleman Smith saw. They even say where she was. It's in a really good book about the Waite-Smith. But I thought the way the symbolism of the cups was really fascinating, because they're actually in the forefront of the image. They're actually more important than even the figure behind the cups. And so I think that's where you see some of the Kabbalah with Waite's cards.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on Mark's asking a good question. Can the death card still mean rebirth or renewal? And Kabbalistically speaking, the answer would be no. It's not the correct position for that. Now, the idea, if we had to look at it, which card in the tarot would be the most likely to connect with those concepts? Well, we have the idea of birth. So we have to look at the Genesis cards, which are basically in the major arcana would be the Magician, the Empress, and the Fool. So we kind of start there. It would have to be one of those three energies because it's a birth. And so we're looking at the beginning or the genesis of the experience, not the ending of it. So I would start with that. Then the idea of renewal or rebirth is the idea of I renew my vows, I'm renewing something. And to me, that renewal aspect has a repetitious aspect to it. The Fool doesn't have that. You know, the Empress can have a little of it if necessary, but the one that really embodies that is the Magician. So in all honesty, you know, from a Kabbalistic point of view, the Magician would more likely to be the major card that would be associated with rebirth or renewal, which again is the idea of starting at the beginning again and kind of, you know, again, trotting that same familiar path, but kind of renewing or starting over. And so to me, again, that would be the one that I would look at if I really wanted a card that would represent that.
I agree with Michael. And then also you can look at the position of the death card in the Kabbalah, and it's facing towards the right pillar. It's like going out. And Michael, you'd said one point, I remember, that there's when you die, we don't really know what happens, no matter what anybody says, while you're living. So there's always this idea that you're somewhat going towards something unknown. And I love that idea. And also, you know, like Michael was saying, sort of it's where it's placed in the Kabbalah doesn't make sense for it to be renewal and change. And in fact, I've seen people, in fact, I recently read for someone who had the death card, and they were basically jumping back into a path they were already familiar with. Because, and that made sense to me, because it's sort of maybe like, I don't know, slightly halfway down the tree. So, you know, to me, we often use just the positions of the cards in the tree really are very accurate, like in terms of just what the pattern is. That is the place we almost always start. And I think there's more than enough material for you to work with just that, the placement of the cards on the tree. Besides, you know, when I think about the symbolism in the cards, first of all, like I said earlier, I wouldn't really recommend trying to interpret them during a reading. You'll be completely confused. I mean, the exception to that is if you're drawn to a repetitive symbol, like say there's a lot of twos. You notice a lot of twos just in the imagery. Like, in fact, you'll notice in the decks, there's this there's a lot of two figures moving around the tarot. And I always thought, okay, someday I'm going to sit down and really think about what that means. Why is there two people in the Hierophant? And there's two children in the Sun card. And what is the two and the two falling out from the tower? So those are the things that the tarot wants you to think about. And as you think about it, you'll just get new insights. It's not supposed to be kind of a literal thing that you're doing, I think, during a reading necessarily.
Yeah, and that brings me to another point that I wanted to touch on, too, is that we have people that do one-card readings, and I don't think you can do a one-card reading. I think you can understand conceptually a card individually, you know, and so forth, the magician or the death card or the fool we could talk about individually. But there are many, many different aspects and elements to it. And if you don't have a pattern, you're not going to know which of those aspects or elements you really want to talk about. So for me, doing an actual reading with the tarot is about reading a pattern of cards or a pattern of energy. And one card does not a pattern make. So I would say three or more would be mandatory for any kind of a reading. And, you know, the bigger the pattern, the more information you have to work with, so to speak. But I think three is absolutely minimum in order to create a pattern. And then you can get into basic, you know, past, present, future. You can look at it a lot of different ways to start to give some context to it. But without that pattern, the individual cards are very difficult to precisely read in any meaningful way because, again, there's just too many aspects, too many elements to it. And with no context, you have no idea where to go with that.
Now, Caroline's had a couple of different questions and comments. To answer your question about what eclipse was Pamela Smith inspired, I don't remember, but it's in that book that you have, The Secrets of the Waite-Smith Tarot. I believe it's a big, thick book. And I think I only came across it maybe recently. I somehow had skimmed over it. I had that book for a while. So she does say where, you know, they say where it was from and the time frame. So, but I'll get it for you later. I just don't have a good memory for things like that. And then I'm not quite clear about your comment. You say the king, the child, the bishop, and the maiden can show four ways of responding to death according to the secrets of WST. Is that the Waite-Smith Tarot? I love that, is what Caroline says. So I'm not quite sure, other than it sounds like you're responding to our discussion about the death card.
Sorry, I was typing and chatting with Mark.
Oh, with the aces, too.
Yeah, that's the aces another, trying to, right. to touch. So yes, the aces are definitely the generation of the suit, and it really represents the idea of the divine vision. So we have that conceptual, the higher up the cards are in the Kabbalah and the tree, the more conceptual they are, the aces being the very highest point. So it's really that sort of divine vision or inspiration. It can be achieving it in the reading if it's placed in a position where it represents a manifested outcome or something, but it's still the idea of the divine vision. Now, again, whether or not that comes to fruition, how it's going to be brought to fruition, there's still a lot of unanswered questions, but it is the genesis, is that idea of that eureka moment of inspiration, and that's really what the aces represent.
One of the things about aces you'll notice in some of the most popular decks, like the Waite and the Thoth and even the Marseille deck, they are so beautiful. And I know that some of you can't see this, but in this one version of the Marseille deck, I love this Ace of Cups. I would tattoo this on me. It's just so beautiful. And so we all sort of get that there's something really important is in the aces, the divine nature of the aces. You rarely see a really poorly drawn ace, whereas, you know, some of the faces and the figures can be definitely poorly drawn depending on what deck you're using. And I agree with everything Michael's saying about the aces, that kind of potential. And of course, depending on the position in the actual layout, what it's going to be more specifically too. So Caroline is adding to her comment, the king resists, the child embraces, the bishop prays and negotiates, the maiden gracefully accepts death. Well, that's interesting. I could see that, you know, and it's true. Children do have an unusual connection to death. When I was younger and I was really big on volunteering, I volunteered at Duke University with this program. It was called Play Therapy. And basically, it was a place where they had this program where children that were very sick and often dying, they had this technique of therapy where they would use with the kids. And it was really their domain that you would go in and whatever the kids wanted to do. And it was true that from what I gathered, I only did it for 6 months, is that sometimes the child that was dying and knew it was way more accepting of it than the poor parents. And it really struck me. I was like, wow, that's amazing. So that can be true. I don't think it's true of all children, but maybe they have some of them have this connection to the spiritual world that could make it easier for them to understand it.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you know, connection to the spiritual world, if there's anything spiritual, it's tarot, which is why it's too bad, again, that some people think it's satanic. It's really not. Certainly had nothing to do with that. And in fact, you know, the genesis of it goes back to Hermeticism and Kabbalah and so forth, certainly nothing evil. And really what it is, especially when you look at the whole tree of life and you're looking at it in its, you know, entirety as opposed to individual cards, is that it very much is a pictorial representation of all the experiences of life. And that's the beauty of it, is that you have the excitement and the angst and the peaceful, content energies and the remorseful energies and the feeling of significance and divine purpose and all of that stuff. And so it really is the mechanics of life. It's all the experiences of life and how we let those things play out. And the whole idea being, I think, that if you have a better understanding of those things as a whole through tarot, is that perhaps you're able to handle life a little bit better, shall we say, you know, that when I'm going through a period, I understand it a little bit better. And then, you know, so forth. And, you know, again, when we think of, you know, an ending, I always tell people if I wasn't here, I'd just be somewhere else, you know. And so for me, again, you know, and maybe that's a bit of tarot thing where you recognize that there's this process by which things get, again, end and begin again and so forth. And so we don't lose our minds as much. And I think able to maintain more of a balance, it's almost a very meditative tool in that sense, you know, almost Buddhistic. So it's a wonderful, wonderful system in that regard, too. And I think just to see life in a more holistic way is one of the great benefits you get by studying the tarot.
There's actually a slight addition to what Caroline said. She was talking about the four figures in the death card of the Waite-Smith deck. And so since I'm not as familiar with that deck on a day-to-day basis, there are four figures, and those are the figures that she is talking about: the king, the child, the bishop, and the maiden. So that's a great example of looking at a card symbolically. And the other thing that's interesting, since they're talking about the death card a little bit, is how it went from the Grim Reaper, which from what I understand from my limited research, it really was the Grim Reaper, because it came out of that period of the plague. And so it evolved into other things. So the death cards really evolved a lot. So it, like, for instance, it's riding a horse now, you know, in some versions of it. So that in itself is kind of interesting to me. And then, of course, Crowley's is very different. The whole, his imagery in the death card has a whole connection to sperm, I think, in there. So, you know, but when you're using whatever deck you're using, to me, that's your tool. And, you know, the more you know your tool and the more you really appreciate it, it's going to teach you things that you won't get. And that's another reason why I'm somewhat of a tarot art snob. And I don't think just because it looks cool that it is a tarot deck. And the reason being is, like, because Michael and I both feel strongly about the connection to Kabbalah, and Kabbalah really does have a very strong system that correlates certain colors and certain plants. And yes, there's some different, there's disagreements on what goes where, but to me that doesn't matter. You can pick whichever one you want and start with it. And you might decide, like, I'm kind of wondering why the moon card is not connected to the moon. I'm really, really a little disturbed by that. I haven't figured out where I'd put it, but I've thought, well, it's the moon. Why can't it just be the moon that's connected to instead of Pisces? So, you know, these are things that you will get on your own eventually, and you'll start questioning, but it's only by using a system for a while that you will do that.
Yeah, and then the moon card too. Again, the idea of, we talked about it earlier in the show, that Crowley says, "Oh, the adventure," and how people see it as a card of deception, but it really isn't. You know, the moon card is the light, is the revelation of the deception. So it's coming to the truth, and getting over that energy of deception. So it really starts to see things again for what it is. And so for me, again, it's really a card of revelation. Is a good way of understanding the moon card, and it's certainly not a card that indicates one is operating under deception. They may have been at one point certainly deceiving themselves or deceived by others, and the right-hand pillar does have that capacity to be able to do that. But then the moon card is all about the revelation and of the truth, and that's really kind of what it's about.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I do remember in the very beginning, I mean, I can definitely see some difficulties with the moon card now that I didn't at the beginning. The very beginning, I really reacted to that whole deception thing and moon is evil. And I remember one of the readers at the Bodhi, she would go on about it. And I have, you know, I'm a Cancerian woman and, it, you know, the moon rules my sun and my Venus. And I was offended by that. So I've come to see, like everything else, Kabbalah will teach you the nuances of the cards. They would teach you when the moon card could be challenging, when it's not challenging. It's all about, like Michael said, the pattern. And I always loved that quote with Aleister Crowley, oh, the adventure, because I do see that as connected to the moon, being that it's on that right-hand pillar, which likes to take risks.
Yeah, and can you imagine a life where no one wanted to be innovative, nobody wanted to take a gamble or a risk or a chance, you know, brave the unknown. If we had nothing but conformity, again, the left-hand pillar being more the pillar of conformity. And it would be kind of a sad life, you know, if we did that, if we were never to do something quote-unquote foolish, you know, the right-hand pillar being the fool's pillar, so to speak, the one that's governed by him. And so again, you know, I can't imagine that we would want a life with no innovation, no... you know, delving into the uncertainty, you know, taking a chance, taking a risk, you know, braving the unknown. I don't think man would have gone to the moon if that were the case. We'd probably still be living in the dark ages. So again, you know, all of that energy of discovery that goes with the right-hand pillar being so important, and that desire to sort of take that leap of faith. And again, that's where we have the Hierophant on that pillar, the idea of the courage to take the leap of faith. And that's essentially what the right-hand pillar is all about. So again, it can't be a negative. But if we're going to do that, again, yes, we are taking the leap of faith, which means sometimes we may be deceived, we may have deceived ourselves, may not be at all what we expected it to be. But it is that leap into the unknown, which Crowley refers to when he says, oh, the adventure.
You know, it's interesting. You were saying, going back to what you said earlier about the moon being about coming to more truth. And even in the imagery, it's there, because in both the moon cards, you can see the reference to the high priestess, because of the, in Aleister Crowley's, you have the two pillars and the two figures, Egyptian figures, and then you also have the sort of two, I think they're pillars or something in the weight deck. And so they're referring to the high priestess coming back to the center, coming back to the truth. And so, again, it's interesting how the symbolism can play over and over again, just in case you missed it. So, hey, you missed it this time. Here, we're going to try another symbol to see if you'll get it that way, you know. So I was just thinking about that, the way you said that, based on the position of the card in the tree, but it's also in the imagery.
Yeah, and keep in mind, as I said, as pillars progress downwards, they become more manifest, from a thought and an idea to an expression, a plan, to implementing that plan, taking an action, and finally getting to a result. And so we're talking about the same energy, but so the threes, the fives, the eights are all very same, similar energies, but the difference being how far along they are in terms of that stage of manifestation, and that's really what it talks about. And then once we reach that point of the tower card, which is now or never, it's time to act, you know, something is going to happen, now or never, as I said, being a big part of that energy. It is the kind of thing where we can't go back again once we kind of reach that point. And unfortunately, again, that's another idea where often the tower is perceived very negatively, in the sense that it's all about, you know, cataclysmic upheavals. And yes, this may result in something good ultimately, but it's not really that so much. It's just the idea that once something is done, it cannot be undone. You know, we can't unring the bell, being a big part of that lesson. And it's not about winners and losers. For every winner, there will be a loser, you know, and so forth. But it's just the idea that something is going to happen. Now there will be, you know, repercussions and consequences, positive or negative, but we can't undo it. And that's really the whole idea of the Tower card, is you can't undo something once it's done.
Yeah, I'm going to write a whole article on the Tower. I found out so many fascinating things about the Tower. It's another one of those really interesting cards in terms of evolution. I did want to quickly look at Caroline's question about the Judgment card. She says it still mystifies me when it appears in a reading. Any insights? Well, the first thing I do with the Judgment card, because I use Kabbalah, is I see it's at the end of the left-hand pillar. And depending upon where it is in an outcome card, sometimes it will literally, let's say you see an eight, and then later on and further in the reading, you see the Judgment card. You can see it's coming to an end, a cycle, that you can see that. I don't work as much with the imagery as I do with the notion that it's connected to Pluto. That's the thing that is speaking to me at this point. And I also associate it with the past. And so there's a whole nother sort of layers of interpretation I will look at sometimes if someone's doing like a family reading. I can see how the judgment card can be that ancestral card from many, many years. But basically to me, it's about like coming to sort of the end of a path. And it does have this sense of release and acceptance in it sometimes, or that you're meant to kind of, because there's nothing really you can do. You're like the part of the end of the left-hand path. Okay, it's coming to conclusion. That's how it is. I'm releasing things. I'm letting go. There's a whole lot of stuff you can look at with the judgment card. But even that simple notion that it's at the end of the left-hand pillar, and what does that pillar represent? Like Michael's talking about earlier, the idea of release and acceptance and letting go. That can actually be very useful just to use that.
Yeah, and also with the judgment card, it is the most solidified card of the major cards. So there's not going to be any more growth or change or anything possible. It just simply is an exhausted energy. So this is all there is. Now, maybe that's enough. Maybe you're satisfied with what is and you don't really desire anything else. But again, if more is desired, then the judgment card, not so great. And then in a reading too, you're always looking for how stable an energy is versus how changeable an energy is. So if a person is hoping something will happen, they've got the judgment card, it may take, you know, a long time. And you know, the cards on the left-hand pillar, the higher up they are, the faster they are to the right-hand pillar, faster, left slower, bottom slower. So the placement in the Kabbalah is the very bottom on the left-hand side. It is by far the slowest. And that's where I kind of like that Crowley actually changed the word to aeon. And if you think about it, the moon, which is its opposite side, is a 28-day cycle, and aeon is 2,000 years. So it gives you the idea of that sense of permanence and you know, that things are not going to move much from here, you know. And so again, I have to make peace with that idea or that concept. And again, if I'm going to try and progress it further, I'm going to be beating my head against the wall. I know that this has come to that end. And that's really what it is. But again, it can be positive in the sense a person may be satisfied with the ending, so to speak. I've lived a good life. I've come to my judgment day. I'm happy with it. You know, there's nothing I do want more. And so that's where, again, you have to look at the whole context of the reading to figure that out. But again, if change or anything is desired from there, to continue on the particular evolution of the energy, it can't really do that once you've reached the judgment card. We're at that exhausted state where, again, it just simply is what it is. And we've come to the conclusion of the energy, basically, as a progression.
Yeah, totally. I totally agree with that. And then she asked also, is the eighth Sephiroth, can it mean surrender, hold? And yes, in our mind, it totally can be accepted. That's it can mean things like acceptance, healing, surrender, letting go, depending on what suit it is, what you're letting go of. And certainly, I think it does have, that is some of the meaning of that particular Sephiroth.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And in a sense, commitment, you know, the idea of the eight energy means I've reached the point where I have to decide if I'm going to stick with this or not. If I'm going to go any further with it. Marriage is actually connected to the eights, believe it or not. It's the idea of forsaking any other possibility to stick with this person. So again, that idea of surrender, acceptance, but think of it both in a negative and a positive sense. You know, the idea of the surrender could be to accept something finally and make peace with it in a sense, so that I'm in a bad relationship, so the time's come now where I just can't take it anymore. I have to accept that this is what it is, and then kind of, you know, decide what to do from there about it. Or I've decided that it's a good relationship. I now want to commit to it and surrender any other possibility, you know, and accept that this is the person I want to be with, but I'm not going to further question anything. And once we've got to the eight, we can't question things further. That's really where we reach that point where the debate must end at some point, and that's where it always ends, is at the eight. So that's that point. And I always tell people, you know, if you're satisfied with something, if you've drawn the eight, great. If not, then realize that this is what it is and decide maybe that's not for you. But it's all about, you know, how content are you? How sad can you be content even with it once we've reached the eight? And that is really the profound question of it.
Well, we're coming to the end of our show today. I want to thank everybody for tuning in and contributing. It's been really fun having these questions today. And we're thinking of doing this maybe on a monthly basis, some sort of tarot topic, and hoping to get people to sort of join in and chime in, whether it's with questions or their own comments. So we really hope that you enjoyed this. And if you go to tarot readers, or you listen, or you read tarot cards, it just helps you to kind of think about tarot in some new ways. That's one of our goals, because we're not the last authority. So anyway, join us next time as we continue to explore the esoteric and the obscure together, and have a beautiful week.